Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here and Chad Marquitz. We are your hosts for this weekend's edition. Also your hosts throughout the week on our website and podcast, kereport.com. A lot of daily editorials and again, a lot of company updates again. So please go back through the week, click on those company updates. And as always, keep in touch with Chad and I through email. All of our email addresses are posted throughout those company postings. We love hearing what all of you think of the companies and what your thoughts are on these markets. Very excited to report that we are kicking off this weekend show with Rick Rule, well known to all of you, investor and speculator, a lot in the resource sector. Now, Rick, it's been a while since I had you back on the show, and I really just wanted to bring everyone up to speed on your thoughts here initially on the precious metals. We'll cover a number of different commodity sectors, but when it comes to gold and silver, they've been in about a year and 3 month correction right now, and the stocks have been crushed, both large cap and small cap stocks. The question that is creeping into some investors' minds is this bull market in gold and silver over? Let's start there. Please share your thoughts, Rick.
Well, the short answer, Corey, is no. A more instructive answer, however, might go into the nuances. The circumstance that we're in is normal and natural in a bull market. This is a cyclical decline in a secular bull market, a statement which I'll defend in a minute. I have been through two prior gold bull markets. The first one beginning in 1970 and ending in 1981. The second one beginning in 2000 and ending in 2011. Note that both of those were 11-year-long affairs. So the duration of a typical bull market is a decade or better. By my counting, we've been into this one for 4 years. So I suggest that we're still in the first half of the bull market. By dimension, too, if you look at this bull market, the metal price has gone from, say, $1,000 an ounce to $1,750 an ounce. The first bull market that I was involved in, the gold price cleared from $35 an ounce, admittedly price controlled, to $850 an ounce. What's that, 24-fold increase, something? The second one, perhaps more representative, the gold price went from $256 to $1,900 an ounce. So both by dimension and duration, if history is a precedent, this bull market is less than halfway done. I think it's important to note, too, that if you look on a representative index of gold equities, the best that I know of is the Barron's Gold Mining Index going back 60 years, what you will see is that periodic periods of malaise and decline are normal and natural. I remember my first big one in 1975. The gold price had gone from $35 to $200. And of course, everybody had the courage of a six-fold price increase. And the gold price then in 1975 declined from $200 an ounce to $100 an ounce, which is to say a 50% decline. And the equities fell further. That, of course, shook the faith of many of the so-called faithful. They took advantage of a bottom to get out and missed a market that moved in 5 short years from $100 an ounce to $850 US per ounce. So make no mistake, what we're going through is normal and natural. Let's look, however, Corey, at why we're in a bull market, separate apart from history. What if this one is different? In my experience, and I'm using gold as a sort of a catch-all phrase for precious metals and precious metals equities, the precious metals prices tend to do well when savers and investors are concerned about the security of their savings denominated in fiat instruments. The world's benchmark savings instrument is the U.S. 10-year Treasury. It's the deepest and most liquid market in the world, allegedly the best issuer in the world. I say allegedly, advisedly. But at any rate, it is the marquee savings instrument in the world. Let's look at that instrument with regards to people being concerned about their savings. In the first instance, and we'll come back to negative interest rates later, This instrument pays 125 basis points a year. You give the U.S. government money, and they give you 1.25% a year for 10 years in a currency which they acknowledge is losing purchasing power at the rate of 5.5% a year. In other words, if you give them money, they promise to give you a greater than 4% negative yield every year, cumulatively and compound for 10 years, which means that at the end of the 10-year period, you get back money that has about a third of its purchasing power remaining. So gold is fighting an investment class that guarantees you loss. My friend Jim Grant calls that return-free risk. Let's look into the details of this, why people might be concerned about fiat instruments. The first thing, of course, is quantitative easing. Corey, if you did that, if you printed flex, you would be charged with counterfeiting and you'd be thrown in the slammer. But if you were a congressman or a member of parliament, it would be called policy and you would become reelected. Irrespective of whether you've committed a felony or not, the creation of spurious currency units, irrespective of who creates them, whether it's Corey or Canada, it has the impact, the immediate arithmetic impact of debasing the currency. And of course, makes people concerned about the efficacy of said currency. The second and probably more alarming threat is debt and deficits. I don't know the appropriate Canadian number, but in the United States, merely at the federal level, we owe $29 trillion, $23 trillion net of the size of the Fed balance sheet. But more alarming than that, the off-balance sheet liabilities of the federal government, things like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, the various unfunded trust funds, exceed, by the estimate of the Congressional Budget Office, $120 trillion. So merely at the federal level, not including state and local governments in the United States, we owe $150 trillion. And we propose to service this debt with a federal budget that is in deficit by $3.5 trillion a year. Explain to me how you service $150 trillion a year in debt when you add to it every year by $3 trillion. The third component, which we've discussed a little bit already, is negative real interest rates. The idea that negative real interest rates are a force of nature is farcical. Why would you loan money to another consumer, foregoing your consumption in favor of his or her immediate consumption, and pay them for the privilege? Why would you loan somebody money at 1.5%, knowing that the currency was depreciating at 5.5%, while simultaneously taking the credit risk? This is truly insane. The fourth reason why I think the precious metals bull market will get underway with greater furor, in fact, than when it started, is because the market share of precious metals and precious metals equities is at almost all-time lows. It is estimated that the market share of precious metals and precious metals related securities in the U.S. market is 0.5% of the market capitalization of all savings and investment products in the United States. Now, what's important to note about that is that the three-decade mean market share of precious metals is estimated to be between 1.5% and 2%. So, gold doesn't need to defeat the U.S. dollar. Gold doesn't need to defeat savings bonds. Gold doesn't need to defeat certificates of deposit. All precious metals need to do is recoup their three-decade-long mean market share, and demand for precious metals and precious metals-related investments will triple, which is precisely what I think is going to happen.
Well, Rick, you've set the stage well there, and that gets into some of the questions that we want to ask about. What will it take to get generalist investors interested in the space again? Do you think it'll be something where we see negative real rates continue to punish savings instruments, as you mentioned, with inflation growing faster, much faster than the treasuries, and people may jump out of the bonds or jump out of those into the safe haven aspect of gold? Or do you think it'll be the attractiveness of the miners that pulls in some of the generalists? And what will it take to get their focus out of the FANG stocks and the runaway tech stocks and take a look at the beleaguered mining sector, which has really cleaned up a lot of the sins of the past? What do you think will happen first, a focus on the gold price or a focus on the mining stocks?
Easy answer is I don't know. I think they're different classes of investor. The investor in physical precious metals, in gold at least, is an insurance-style investor, someone who buys precious metals because they are nervous, they're afraid, they want insurance. I count myself partly among that class. I'm in the odd position of owning a fair bit of precious metals, physical precious metals, and hoping the price doesn't go up, because the circumstance that causes their price to go up is fairly dramatic. And that drama is something I prefer not to experience later in life. The precious metals equity investor or speculator is in a very different category. That's a somewhat more aggressive person. And I'm not sure that precious metals mining stocks will compete particularly against general market securities or tech stocks, but they don't have to. Their market share is infinitesimal. You don't need to change a decimal point. You need to change a hundredth of a decimal point in order to have an impact on the market. And I think that's going to occur. As you suggest, the sins that the mining industry exhibited in the 2000 to 2011 period are still fresh in the minds of both managers and investors. And the consequence of that is that the industry thus far, with perhaps the mistake of the penny dreadful industry, the penny stocks, but the real mining stocks have been run prudently, perhaps too prudently in the last 10 years. One consequence of that is that they are generating cash flow in amounts that the industry has never seen before. And that cash will ultimately get spent. It will perhaps get spent on capital projects. It will perhaps get spent on mergers and acquisitions. It will certainly get spent on dividends, and it will probably be spent on share buybacks. All of those are good for the equities prices. Every single one of them, at least in the near term, is good for equities prices. So I believe that the metals will go higher because I believe that the metals compete with other forms of savings products, which don't work in this environment. I believe the equities will work, both because I believe that the metals prices will go higher, but also because I believe that they're fundamentally cheap, even at today's precious metals prices. So I think the answer to your question is yes and yes.
So Rick, I guess just to summarize all this, look, I do agree with you that debt, low interest rates, negative real interest rates, inflation, that ties in with the negative real interest rates. These should be key drivers to gold. And even with gold above, let's say, 1700 right now, it is still broadly higher than it has been through its history. However, it is off of its highs. But for that speculator, when they're seeing the equity markets and tech stocks and a wide range of other stocks continue to move higher, and then they look at their gold stocks or their silver stocks and see them continue to break down, especially over that last year, it does scare some investors away. I know that you always say investors should like lower prices. That means they're getting stock on sale. The problem is they've underperformed the markets for so long that it has driven away a wide range of investors and even pushed some other investors into some other newer markets like cryptocurrencies. Why do you think that is, and how does that actually get changed from the speculator standpoint?
It gets changed when it's too late, Corey. That's the way markets work. On your show 3 years ago, I was talking to your listeners, telling them, asking them to buy uranium stocks. I did everything but call their damn broker for them. That isn't what they wanted. They wanted pot stocks. There isn't much to be done in the near term for people who are inhabited by fear of missing out, or for people who propose to overpay. All I propose to do is be their pawnbroker. When an asset class I find is attractive is out of favor, I buy it aggressively. When it returns to favor, I sell it aggressively. It's interesting that the same people who I couldn't beat into buying uranium stocks when they were selling at a quarter of the current levels are now begging me for stock tips. That's the nature of human nature. It's why 90% of speculators are losers. It's why people go to Las Vegas casinos. There seems to be a determination on the part of most speculators to lose.
Well, Rick, that's an interesting place to pick up the uranium story because, of course, people are supposed to buy when it's low and sell when it's high, but they usually do just the opposite of that. But we've seen quite a move in the uranium market really over the last year and a half, but especially lately in lieu of the Sprott at the market financing and buying physical uranium in the spot market, as well as a number of non-producers, about a half dozen, also buying in the spot market, in addition to producers like Cameco and Ur Energy, also buying in the spot market. As a result, we've seen a pretty big move in the spot price recently, and a lot of the company valuations have skyrocketed even higher. You made an interesting remark in a recent interview, and I'd love you to touch on it again, about how this compares to the last uranium cycle as far as the company valuations and why you're not seeing as much upside now as you did at the beginning of that previous cycle.
Well, the first thing is that the easy money has been made in uranium. At $18 a pound, the price had to go up. It had to go up. It had to go up because the total industry average cost of production is about $60 a pound. So the industry'd make the stuff for 60. And when I say total cost, I don't just mean mine site cost. I mean exploration cost and cost of capital. The industry'd make the stuff for $60 a pound and sell it for 20, lose $40 a pound, and do it 130 million times a year. You know, that was a rather boring business. Offsetting that was the fact that uranium is an indispensable part of the way we live. And demand for electricity is growing, not declining, so it becomes more indispensable. And either the price of uranium had to rise to the level where the industry earned its cost of capital, or there wouldn't be any more uranium. And if there wasn't any more uranium in little tiny countries like the United States, the lights would go out. So that wasn't going to happen. The easy money has already been made. Now, I don't want to discourage people from being in the uranium business, because if you look forward 2 or 3 years, from $44, $45, $46 a pound, it is, to me, much more likely than not that the price goes up to $70 or $75 a pound, meaning that there is good money ahead if you have a 2 or 3 year horizon. But remember that the malaise that we've just experienced in precious metals and precious metals mining stocks can easily afflict the uranium business too. So if you aren't thinking in 2 or 3 year timeframes, you need to begin to be cautious in the uranium space. And this market will be different than the last market for two primary reasons. The first reason is, as you suggest, the market capitalizations now are much higher. In the last uranium bull market, I counted it starting in 2000. Most people counted it starting in 2003. The market capitalizations in the junior space were infinitesimal. If I look back, I believe there were five juniors that survived a 20-year bear market. And in the ensuing bull market, the poorest performing of that collection of five went up 22 to 1. But part of the reason it went so high was that they started with market capitalizations that were absurdly low. Companies like the Canadian Strathmore, a $4 million market cap. International Uranium, run by the Lundins, with an $18 million market cap and $30 million cash in the treasury. The enterprise value was actually negative. Paladin Uranium, 1.6 million market cap. Very often now, the starting market caps of uranium juniors are 75 million or 100 million, which means if you look at the market caps that prevailed 2 decades ago, they've already achieved 10-bagger status relative to market cap. It's difficult to multiply to the same dimension a much larger starting market cap. The second thing that I think we all need to pay attention to is the emergence of a very powerful swing producer, Kazatomprom, which has an unusual ability to ramp up production in the 3 to 5 year time frame rather than the 10 to 15 year time frame that has beset traditional producers. One of the things that you note in natural resource-based businesses is that when the price of a commodity goes through the incentive price to produce it, the supply response isn't instantaneous because the industry needs to go through the permitting, the financing, and the building process to bring reserves onto production. In the case of Kazatomprom, you have unusual flexibility with regards to supply. That isn't to say that we aren't going to experience a continuation of this bull market and that there won't be really good money to be made. There will be, and I intend to participate it. But people who are looking at this market as having tenfold or 15-fold potential across the sort of length and breadth of the market are due to be disappointed.
Now, Rick, one of the key drivers, at least in the short term, to the uranium price, and this is after the stocks already ran. So something to consider. The uranium stocks definitely led before the uranium price started to move, but that is the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust that fairly aggressively went into the market and started buying a lot of that excess supply that was in that market. They weren't waiting around for, let's say, other companies to do that. They have played a pretty big role in moving that uranium price higher in the near term. How sustainable is this? How big of a deal is this in your eyes?
Corey, I need to plead guilty, first of all, to substantially underestimating the impact that our own product would have on my market. I had anticipated that when the Sprott Trust listed on the New York Stock Exchange, that the volumes would be such that the at-the-market could make a difference in the spot market. I hadn't understood how much more globalized securities markets are now, or frankly, how thin the spot market is. And I would suggest to you that 90% of the move in the spot market from $30 to a high of 50, now settling off in the high 40s, has been due to the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. It has been an overwhelming success from the point of view of the speculators who are in it, from the point of view of Sprott itself, and also from the point of view of the uranium industry. It's important to note that the spot market was beleaguered, which is to say, very few bidders and a lot of supply. A lot of the supply coming, I would suspect, from Japanese inventories themselves supply because of the shutdown of the Japanese nuclear fleet after Fukushima. The fact that there was a lot of supply overhang and no bidders meant that you had a market that was lower or directionless until a new bidder came in. And that new bidder changed everything. You will note that the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust can only buy new uranium inventories when it trades at a premium to net asset value. In other words, Sprott will not issue shares if they dilute existing holders. So today is an example where the trust is selling at a 1.5% discount to the net asset value, which on the one hand makes it a much better buy for speculators. They will not be issuing units, they will not be taking in new money, and they will not be buying physical supplies. But to the extent that fondness for the uranium narrative picks up again and flows come into the trust, they will again be, by their charter, in the money buying physical uranium supplies. I would suspect, given the shareholder composition of Sprott's other trusts in precious metals, where probably 90% of the shareholders in those physical precious metals trusts are Americans, that the listing of the Sprott Trust on the New York Stock Exchange, which I suspect will occur towards the end of the first calendar quarter in 2022, will continue to have a profound impact on uranium pricing. Note, too, that very, very recently, within the last month, there have been very encouraging noises coming out of Japan about a shifting of the political winds in favor of nuclear. The Japanese public, as well as the Japanese government, is coming to understand that the only prayer that Japan has of coming close to their Paris and Kyoto promises with regards to carbon generation will be to restart the nuclear fleet. Right now, as I understand it, something like 10 of 50 reactors are operating, which leaves 40 reactors down. The restart of the Japanese nuclear fleet, I suggest, would have a greater impact on the uranium price than the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust has.
Well, Rick, just one more question as we wrap up on uranium, and that is the contracting cycle. What we hope to see in the sector is the utility companies come back to the table with the producers or the development companies that could bring on production and start locking in those long-term offtake agreements, which is really what drives the longer-term pricing. Do you think we're getting closer to that with this recent price move? And has this moved things forward maybe by a year or two to get that contracting cycle started?
Yes and yes. The utilities had no incentive to enter into fixed price contracts at a uranium price which was required for the solvency of the miners, simply because there was so much material in the spot market, particularly Japanese material, that they could buy for substantially less. The circumstance now where the spot market has tightened up to the extent it has, and particularly if it keeps tightening, will be that the utilities will be forced to go into the term market. And by utilities, I mean utilities around the world. New built nuclear capacity, new reactors, which characteristically cost between $5 and $7 billion to build, as part of their financing documents, are increasingly required to secure fuel supplies for long enough to amortize the loans, which means that they can't rely on the spot market because the lenders don't want to rely on the spot market. So new build uraniums will almost by definition be term market buyers rather than spot market buyers. Because of the softness in the spot market and because of the ease with which utilities have been able to meet their near-term needs from the spot market, there has been a lot of the refueling cycle that has turned into informal or spot market refueling rather than term market refueling. I think that party's come to a screeching halt, as has, by the way, the carry trade. And I think, too, that the realization that 30 million pounds of supply has been locked away by Sprott, and there is an impending shift in Japanese inventories from material held for sale to material held for fuel, that utilities will need to rely on the term market. I think you will see transactions taking place pretty quickly between China General Nuclear and Kazatomprom, as an example. And you have heard, too, from Cameco that they have no intention of starting MacArthur or Cigar unless they get term contracts for enough supply that they can operate those facilities and earn a reasonable return on capital employed for their shareholders. So I think, yes, sooner rather than later, you're going to see a return of the term market.
All right, Rick, before we wrap it up here, I know that you have a special offer for everyone listening. Take us through that offer of looking at some of the stocks within some of our listeners' portfolio, please.
That offer is this. If you care about what I have to say about resources, but more importantly, the resource investments that you have made, if you visit a website, ruleinvestmentmedia.com, all one word, ruleinvestmentmedia.com, enter your natural resource stocks there. Please, by the way, no pot stocks. Please no crypto, please no tech stocks, just resource stocks. I'll rank those 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst. I will comment on individual issues where I think my comments might have value. And in addition, if you mention charts in the question and comment section, I will include the Barron's Gold Mining Index chart, which we referred to earlier, and a 100-year commodity chart, which talks about just how cheap commodities are relative to other asset classes going back 100 years. Once again, ruleinvestmentmedia.com.
All right. Thank you for that offer, Rick. I will post a link to that website to make it easier for everybody. And hey, Rick, great having you back on the show. I'm going to be reaching out to you a bit more regularly as hopefully this market starts turning here, but you have laid out some, I guess, long-term optimistic comments for all these precious metals investors. Everyone, stick around. We're going to be right back with Joe Mazumdar.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.